Good morning. I was thinking about, as we were singing, the fact that we all come from different churches. Most Sundays you are probably in a place of worship, and while they are very different, and they probably the places that we meet look different, we are united by many of the songs we sing. At least some of them are common to the places where we worship, and we are also united by our love for this book, and by the fact that Jesus is at the center of our lives. And while there may be many other things we differ on, we are united by those things. And as I was singing these songs, many of which we sing at my church, I was thinking about some of those differences. In the last several years, our family has been a part of a church in downtown Chicago. It's known as the West Loop neighborhood of Chicago. It's the fastest growing neighborhood in the city. Used to be an area, honestly, where you didn't want to go. You didn't want to walk down there. It was kind of an unsafe place. But it's being changed in many, many ways. Google moved in with 500 jobs, and now there's a Target. You know, if there's a Target anywhere, it's for real now. So it's really becoming revitalized in many ways, and lots of young people live there. And the young couple who started the church that we're a part of called Soul City Church honestly didn't know 5 years ago that it was going to be this growing neighborhood. They just sensed that that's where God wanted them to be. Someone graciously allowed us to use a warehouse that we repurposed for the first 2 years for free. We were in this space, and the church is really growing. Warren and I are certainly two of the oldest people, if not the oldest people, in the church. But we worship together in this very small space. It only holds 300 people, so we have four services back-to-back. And the words for our songs up on the screen, the pictures behind them, are not the beautiful nature that is so appropriate here at Mount Hermon and the pictures of the trees, etc. They've taken photos of the West Loop, so we see concrete jungle buildings like the landscape of Chicago as we sing the same songs that many of you sing. But it is a joy to worship with you and to find out as you connect with one another that the kingdom of God is so big and vast. And one day we're all going to be singing together, aren't we, in heaven, all of these songs. If you didn't get a handout when you came in, you might want to raise your hand, and there's people in the back. It's green. You might want to grab that. And before we get into the content today, yeah, they're coming with them. So just keep your hands up and they'll find you. I want to just tell you kind of a story for free about a friend of mine who's been through all of these seasons many times in his life. And because we're in the Olympics week, I just don't want to forget to tell you this story. Because when you get home, you may be missing the Olympics right now, but when you get home on Monday night, there's going to be a race that I want to tell you the backstory, just in case NBC Sports doesn't do this justice, because I have a feeling they may not tell this story. Willow Creek, the church that I helped to begin, was started by a bunch of young people. And one of the guys who came down from Michigan, who was Bill Hybels' best friend from the time he was a baby, helped to start the church. His name is Joel Jaeger. And Joel grew up on a farm in Michigan, and when he was a toddler, he contracted the polio disease. And so his leg, his one leg, is much smaller than the other leg. And for his whole life, he kind of walks like this. He drags that weaker leg. And Joel joined our team as a volunteer. For many years, he worked two jobs. He worked, got up at 4 a.m., worked in the tool and die industry for a good 8-9 hours, and then would come over to the church as our first technical director. He was the guy in the sound booth and setting up everything. He's got the gift of helps. He'll do anything to serve you. Went through a difficult season with a divorce of his earliest marriage, and he actually ended up being a roommate of my husband when my husband was single. And I would come over to the house, and Joel, this was his dinner. He was watching Mork and Mindy with a jar of peanut, not, some of you don't even know who that is, but anyway, it was a TV show. A jar of peanut butter and saltine crackers that he was dipping into the peanut butter. So that was Joel's life for a bit. Anyway, God was good and gracious, and he later met another woman named Kathy, who's his wife to this day. And so here's this guy. He has two children, a son and a daughter. And when his son was quite young in grammar school, he started to love running. And my daughter was in track also, and we would go to some track meets where his son, whose name is Evan, was lapping on the mile so far ahead of anybody else everybody knew this kid, something special about this kid. Tall, lean, real lanky. And anyway, now today, after going to the University of Wisconsin and then being recruited by Nike, lives out in Oregon, he was like trying to find his sport or his event. And they didn't have anybody from the U.S. who was very good at the steeplechase race. So his coach saw something in him and said, I think this kid could actually be really good at this. And he is. In the London Olympics, I think he was fifth or sixth, and he's got a shot at a medal. His name is Evan Jaeger, and he will be racing Monday night, the 15th, I think that is, if you want to watch. But the coolest thing is his father, Joel, and Kathy are flying to Rio for this. And so here's a man who's never walked normally in his whole life with a son that can run like the wind. And every time I see him, I can't handle it. It's such an example of God's grace. And Evan is an outstanding follower of Jesus and a great example on the Olympic team. And whether he wins or not, gosh, it's just such a great story. So I don't know if NBC will tell it, so I want to tell you my Evan story. Okay, so you got this, and the first page is really just yesterday. So you can just keep that for some of the things that we talked about yesterday. But yesterday, we laid the groundwork for the seasons of the soul and how they played out in the life of Joseph. We're going to revisit Joseph a little bit this morning. And we're going to go deeper in the season of fall. Since yesterday morning, I have had so many conversations with many of you, and my theory is true. Many people are going through transition. Some of you are in the other seasons, and we're going to get into them on Thursday and Friday, but we really wanted to take a deeper dive, and I feel a little bit like a personal expert on transition because of my last 5 years, all the reading that I've done, and I'm also a leadership coach, so I work with a lot of people who are going through transition professionally and in ministry as well. So we learned yesterday that there's three phases. There's the endings phase, the neutral zone, and new beginnings. In that endings phase, we ask ourselves, what is over now? We try to have some closure. We try to let go of what is over now and grieve what is over now, which is really difficult to do. And then we realize that there are lessons to be learned even in the neutral zone when we have to learn how to wait. Several years ago, maybe some of you have heard of a pastor from Grand Rapids named Pastor Jeff Mannion. And I heard him speak, and it impacted me greatly because he tells us that this neutral zone time is a time when we can learn tremendous lessons. And he wrote a book about it called The Land Between. It's really the story of the children of Israel between Egypt and the Promised Land. How many years were they in the land between? Yeah, 40 years. Apparently, they had a lot to learn. God had them in that neutral zone for a really long time. And so Jeff Mannion masterfully explores that story. And he says there is a purpose in the time when we are not where we were and we're not yet where we're going, that God has a purpose in that. And here's what he says. I put this quote in your notes, I believe. He says, I firmly believe that the land between, that space where we feel lost or lonely or deeply hurt, is fertile ground for our spiritual transformation and for God's grace to be revealed in magnificent ways. But while the land between is prime real estate for faith transformation, that's one possibility, you could have faith transformation, it is also the space where we can grow resentful, bitter, and caustic if our responses are unguarded. The wilderness where faith can thrive is the very desert where it can dry up and die. When you and I find ourselves in this space between what is familiar and what is unknown, what will we choose? That's really the question. Because we could have a downward spiral in this space. And I know, because I've tasted this, we could become caustic, bitter, resentful. We could become irritable. We could become despairing, really, wondering if we're ever going to know what's next. So this leads us to another question during transition, which is simply, what am I learning? God, what are the lessons you have for me? I hope that none of us will be in that land between for 40 years, like the children of Israel were. I hope we'll learn our lessons quicker than that and be able to move on. But there are always lessons to be learned in the seasons of fall. And God's primary agenda for us, we heard it in David's prayer just a moment ago. God's primary agenda for us is to become more like Jesus in every way. That, you know, that is the big idea. If we ever get confused, it's not about knowledge. And I think we get confused about this. I am so not against learning from the Bible. I think it's wonderful. But the point is not collecting knowledge. The point is not who's the smartest, who knows the most Greek or Hebrew or whatever. The point is this learning resulting in transformation? Over time, can I look back and say, I'm more like Jesus today than I was a few years ago? I'm kinder, I'm more patient, I'm more loving, I'm more generous, I'm less greedy, I'm not so easily irritable, I deal with my anger in a healthy way. Those are the questions, and this is the kind of work that God wants to do in us when we are in transition. Seasons of transition are tools for us, and this was definitely true for Joseph. So I want to go back to his story. When we left him, he had been sold by his brothers into slavery, right, in Egypt. He'd been transported to this foreign land, something he didn't know at all. Potiphar, an Egyptian official, bought Joseph. So take a look at his new situation. This is in Genesis 39, starting at verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph. Remember, we said that all together, but the Lord was with Joseph. Well, here he's with him again, so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. Okay, so this sounds like good times, right? Again, for Joseph. He was flourishing in spite of being very far from home. But, big word there, but Joseph was a good-looking guy. And the boss's wife tried to seduce him. And when the husband returned, she lied. She claimed that Joseph had pursued her. So we read in Genesis 39, verse 20, these very sobering words. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Once again, Joseph is in that waiting room, neutral zone kind of place, and he is about to learn some very vital lessons in that place. I mentioned that I've been in a season of fall myself. I'm coming out of it now, but for several years I was. And here's one of the lessons that I learned. I learned that my worth, my sense of my own worth, was far too attached to what I did. I used to teach people. I remember this back when I was at Willow. I used to teach people in seminars, your identity should never be about your job, about a title you hold, about a place you serve, a position you have, even about a role you play. That shouldn't be your identity. But then it happened to me. And I found myself in this transition time, in this neutral zone time, and I felt, as I mentioned yesterday, lost. When I walk with church leaders primarily and some leaders in the marketplace as well these days, what many of them are discovering is how attached their identity is to what they do, to what people know them for, to how long they've been somewhere. And this is a big mistake for many of us, because that is not where our identity should be grounded. And here's what I learned, and here's what I'm growing to learn, and this is going to be a lifelong process, I think, for me, but I've made a lot of progress in the last few years. Who am I? I'm not a teacher. I'm not a wife and mother primarily. I'm not an author. I'm not a coach. I am a treasured daughter of the Most High God. That is who I am. All the rest is sort of on the peripheral. I am a treasured daughter of the Most High God. And the more I have learned to ground my identity in that place, the healthier I've been. The less I have felt the need to push and grasp and try to manipulate, try to make my way, try to seek approval from other people, try to manage my image, my social networking, all of that stuff, the more I have let go of that and been able to say, you know what, that is not essentially who I am. And in all of eternity, all that stuff's not really going to matter very much. What's going to matter is, am I God's daughter? Am I loving him? And am I loving other people? If you're going through a season of fall, I want to urge you to dig, and it's a digging process for the deeper inner message and lessons God has for you to learn. It might be a completely different lessons than the ones I learned. Life is not always going to be comfortable, and it is in times of transition that we can feel the most alive. I want to tell you about my friend named Shar. Shar, I have known since she was my Sunday school teacher when I was in high school, back in the church where I grew up, and she recently celebrated her 95th birthday. But I want to tell you some of the transitions she's faced in her life. She married her high school sweetheart. She went to Wheaton College, and she married her high school sweetheart named John. And they were filmmakers together. They had one son. One day, when they were out on a film shoot, a crew member came running and told Shar something is wrong with John. And she found him on the floor. He was dead immediately from a heart attack, and he was only 41. Shar was not yet 40. She was in her late 30s. She says the hardest thing she ever had to do was tell their 13-year-old son that his father was never coming back. Shar was a widow for 18 years, and that's really the season that I knew her best. She worked a lot. She was a writer. She worked for the Young Life organization and a lot of other Christian organizations, helped write a bunch of books. And then at the age of 59, Shar married a second time. A guy who was a widower, Wes was his name, and I got to go to that wedding. It was a very happy day. But shortly after they were married, very shortly, they discovered that Wes had leukemia. So Shar moved into the hospital with him for the last 7 weeks of his life, and then she became a widow again. She's been a widow now for another 35 years or so. But throughout her life, she has had to let go. In fact, now, she's got a little dementia, so when I go to visit her, I can tell she's letting go in that last phase of life. But she has learned so much in these seasons of transitions. I thought I had a photo of her, and I couldn't find it on my computer, but I wish I could show you her face. I think it's one of the most beautiful faces I've ever seen, and it's filled with wrinkles. But she has the biggest smile. Her eyes shine. And when she starts to talk about God, she sees him as her home, as her rock, as her refuge. He has walked with her through every single season. And this leads us to another key question we must ask in a season of change, which is, who am I trusting? Who am I trusting? Who am I holding on to? Because, you know, everybody on the planet goes through change. Those who follow Jesus and those who don't. But the difference for us can be that we can choose to trust God. That is the very essence of our faith. Not just when the circumstances of life please us, but also when those winds of change start blowing. This requires heroic kind of courage, really, because we cannot see clearly. We cannot see clearly, but we're still choosing to trust. We have a longing, I think, all of us, for someone to watch over us. There's an old song called Someone to Watch Over Me. We all want someone to watch over us. And in Psalm 121, we discover that our God does precisely that. Look at this verse in light of transitions, okay? This is from Psalm 121, 7 and 8. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. He'll watch over your endings. He'll watch over the neutral zone. And he'll watch over the new beginnings, now and forevermore. God sees you. He sees you. He's with you. You may feel shaky. You may feel lost. But he has a purpose in all of this. And over time, our trust bank with God will grow. I look back now and I see how God has grown my trust in the last several years. And I learned, just as Joseph did, that our God is absolutely trustworthy. Absolutely. Time and again, he has shown me that he is actually guiding my steps. And I'm learning vital lessons in this season that I couldn't learn any other way. Another lesson that I've learned is, as we're in this new young church, I'm learning that God has a purpose for Warren and me to come alongside these young leaders. It's a completely different kind of muscle. It's a mentoring kind of muscle. It's a walking with. It's a supportive kind of muscle. It's not the one with all the great new ideas. It's the one who's guiding and walking with them and hopefully bringing some wisdom and perspective along the way. And I admit there are moments when I miss that other season, you know, when I go back and I grieve and I say, I liked being the young ones that everyone came to and said, so how should we do church? And, you know, what are your ideas and everything? Now I am in this completely other place where I respond to the energy and the enthusiasm and the new ideas of a completely different generation. And they think they came up with everything, which is really funny. And I smile and try to be gracious and say, what a great idea. Because it's humbling to be in this new season, but it's very rich as well. I've had more young people, both men and women, say to me, really? You get that? Or you've been there before? Or you understand this? And I feel like God gives me this little gift one-on-one with them, to be with them and to be for them. But it's a new muscle. It's a new lesson. Here's some verses that I memorized. I'm not going to try to say them from memory because I'll probably blank, but here's some verses I memorized during my season of transition because I needed to become like a little child again in terms of trust. From Psalm 131, my heart is not proud, Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great things or things too wonderful for me, but I have calmed myself and quieted my ambitions. Big phrase. Quieted my ambitions. I am like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child, I am content. That image, do you see the imagery there? Recently, I was teaching at a church in Wisconsin, and after the service, a young mother came and sat down next to me, and she was holding a two-year-old who had gotten feverish during Sunday school prior to the big church service. And so she hadn't been sick at home, but she got sick that morning. And so the mother had gone to get her, and she was holding her. And the little girl was all snuggled up against her mother's chest, and she didn't want to be anywhere else. She was clinging to her mom, and she didn't look very well. And I thought of this verse. That is the picture of how you and I are to crawl up, in a sense, in the lap of our Heavenly Father, and let him hold us, and let him be surrounding us in this sense of refuge and strength. That's what we need when we're feeling shaky and lost. If you find yourself in the neutral zone and you're tired of waiting, and you're frustrated and you can't see the answer you're looking for, I urge you to crawl into the lap of your Heavenly Father and trust him, even though your path is not yet clear. Now, many of you might relate to a picture that I give some of the people that I'm coaching. And as I made this handout, I don't know how to make graphs. So if I had a whiteboard up here, here's how it would look. I put the words on your page, starting with pioneering. But maybe you can draw this better because the lateral look doesn't work for what I'm trying to describe. So what I would draw in the pioneering phase, this is for those of you who are in the professional world in some respect. Normally what I think happens is we start out pioneering something. And so it's kind of up. It's up and to the right. There's a few dips along the way, but it's mostly up. And what you're doing is you're building something, right? You're probably new at it, so you're learning. You're pioneering. You're forging some new territory. You are mostly exhilarated. In the pioneering phase, though, sometimes you feel like you're out at the edge of your skis. You know, you're like, I really don't know what I'm doing, and if anybody finds out, I'm going to be messed up. I used to think that at Willow Creek a lot, because early on, I mean, we just started to build a church. We were very young. We didn't know what the heck we were doing, and all of a sudden, people wanted to come to conferences, etc. And I remember one of the first conferences, I was supposed to teach a workshop, and I saw the cars pulling into the church parking lot, and here was my thought. I thought, these people have no idea that we just made this up as we went along, and we really don't know what we're doing. And I really felt that sense of inadequacy. But that's how you feel in the pioneering phase. And it's exciting. And some of you have been there. And it can last a couple years. Sometimes, for me, I would say the pioneering phase at Willow, because we were changing so much, lasted 10 to 15 years, where I just felt like I'm pioneering, I'm out there, I'm doing something new, and I'm so dependent on God, and I'm just figuring it out day by day by day, building a team, you know, figuring out best processes, best practices, that kind of thing. So whatever field you're in, you might be in a pioneering kind of phase. Then, and this sounds like a bad word, but it's really not, there's sort of a plateauing. So you're kind of up, 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 and then there's a little bit more even phase. And this could last any number of years, depending on your situation. This is where, not in a prideful way, but you really have figured some things out, okay? So it's not as scary. You feel a little bit more expertise. You feel like you're in your sweet spot. You've probably adjusted job descriptions so that you're kind of where you need to be. In the plateauing phase, many times I would drive home and think, I was born for this. And also, I can't believe I get to do this. I can't believe I get to do this. I would do this even if I didn't get paid, but don't tell anybody that, you know, that kind of thing. So the plateauing phase is basically a time where you feel a little bit more confidence, less tentative, and maybe other people also look to you and think that person, you know, has some wisdom in this area. They kind of know what they're doing. And again, I can't tell you how long that lasts, but somewhere along the way, in that plateauing phase, you could draw like a little asterisk, a little star, and one of two things happens. Either it's your own inner restless voice, which comes many times from the Holy Spirit, where you're starting to think, I think a change is coming. So it could be your own idea, or some of you have experienced where it's someone else's idea. In other words, someone comes to you, either they're going to let go some people or they want to restructure. We used to call that the dreaded R word at Willow because it felt like we were restructuring all the time. And that means change, okay? But something happens somewhere in that plateau phase where you start to think, I think a shift is coming. And it might be a long time before you respond to that. It might be quite a while before anything really does substantively change. For me, I think it was at least a year before I knew that my time was done and I was going to actually resign. For some people, it's very fast. For some people, it comes out of the blue, and it was not invited. It was something that is inflicted, in a sense, on you. And we had to do, one time, a lot of layoffs 1 year, and that was extremely painful. So it could be a restless voice, or it could be an interruption, a divine invitation to make a change, to leave, but something happens there. And then what happens is you are ushered into transition. So whether you initiate it or someone else initiates it, now you're in that transition of endings and neutral zone and new beginnings. And eventually, the way God works, and some of you have been through this, and this is what I'm in now, you do start something new, and guess what you are again? You're a pioneer. The whole thing goes back to the beginning, eventually, after you get through the neutral zone, and now you're in a new beginning, and you feel like a pioneer again. Even if you go to another place and you have a similar role to what you had in the previous place, you're still a pioneer because you're learning a new culture. If you're a senior pastor or something, you're learning a new culture, whatever your role might be. In the corporate world, it's the same. I coach some corporate people, and they describe to me how they develop this expertise, and for a while they're plateaued and they're really where they need to be. And then they either get a promotion or they get moved or they go somewhere else to a new job and they're starting over in a sense, which is good because it's actually quite humbling. So I want to give you, if you're in a season of fall, a few more very practical steps to take during this season. Some of these are from my own experience. Some of them are from William Bridges, who I mentioned yesterday. And just some 5 key ideas, which I've written down for you. First of all, know that it's normal to be uncomfortable. Just accept that distress, Bridges says, distress is not a sign that something has gone wrong. It's a sign that something is changing. And so there is going to be some distress. We're going to be in this place in our lives many, many times. And some of us react to change a little bit differently than others. So again, if I had a whiteboard, here's what I would draw. On this side, I would draw a big J, the letter J. And on this side, I would draw a big P, the letter P. How many of you have ever taken the Myers-Briggs test? A very old personality test that it's still in lots of use today. Lots of you. Okay. I am talking about just one of the measurements on Myers-Briggs, the J and the P. In the Myers-Briggs language, the J stands for judging, which I don't even know what that means. But in Willow speak, what we called it was just settle it. Just settle it. Okay, so those are people who like things to be structured, who like to know the plan, who want things to be in great detail and well organized, and generally don't appreciate change that much. They feel, that's putting it mildly, they feel threatened by change. So if someone comes in and says, new vision, yay, we got a new vision for our church or for our organization, the J's, they feel it physically. They break out in a little bit of sweat. Why do we need a change? We don't need a new vision. I like the old vision. It's just great, okay? So an extreme J would be that way. And by the way, there's gradations of this, obviously. The P, Myers-Briggs calls that perceiving. Again, I'm not sure what that means. But we used to call it play it by ear, okay? So this is the person who is very spontaneous, who likes to make stuff up as they go along, loves brainstorming meetings, loves strategy, loves to figure that stuff out, doesn't really want to be held tightly to a plan. They would like to be surprised, loves the unpredictability of it all, okay? And then there's people kind of in between. But you're really generally one or the other, a J or a P. Let me give you an example in a family situation. There's four people in our family. We have one J and three P's, okay? My husband and I, that's one of the rare things we have in common. We're both play it by ear, and our younger daughter is a little more play it by ear. But our older daughter, Samantha, is a J. So when we go on vacation, she will say the night before, you know, the next day, she'll say, so what's the plan for tomorrow? And she really wants to know. And Warren or I will say, I don't know, we'll see. Her two least favorite words, we'll see. We'll say, you know, we want to see what the weather's going to be like. We want to see, you know, what we feel like in the morning. Warren's not a morning person, so he kind of wants to go with the flow and just see when he gets up. And she hates that because she wants to go to bed at night and she wants to lay out the outfit she's going to wear the next day and she wants to know what to anticipate, how early she should get up, if she's going to do a run, when she's going to do her run, all that kind of stuff. So you can see how in a family relationship this can cause tension. It's also very true, obviously, in any leadership situation. So I led a department, all the worship artists, all the people who were very creative, many of whom were on the P side of things. However, we had quite a few J's, and any organization needs both, by the way. So we had some people, particularly our administrators, our technical people. So Bill Hybels is an off-the-end-of-the-continuum play-it-by-ear person. So I would sit with him down in the front for services, and he would get this gleam in his eye, and I thought, uh-oh. Even though I'm a play-it-by-ear person, I was worried about my team because he wanted to shake things up. He just wanted to change something. And he would say, you know, he would probably tell you half the time the Holy Spirit told him, but I would say, no, you just want to change it. You know, don't give me that. You just want to change it because you're bored. And so he would look at me and goes, let's do a different song. Or let's just, you know, I'll just go up there now and lead something else. And I'd be like, okay, whatever. And I'm thinking, my team, who are many are J's, there's somebody running words in the back, like Lydia is doing for us here. There's somebody running words. There's somebody running sound. There's somebody running lights. And they're all having a heart attack right now because he's changing things. And those are the J's. So you have to understand, when you're going through change, do you personally tend to be more of a J because it's going to be harder for you in this whole transition? Or are you more of a play it by ear? That doesn't mean it's easy for you, but you can ride with it maybe a little bit easier, and you're willing to hang with the anticipation of what might be next. Turn to the person next to you and tell them, do you tend to be more of a J, like an extreme J, kind of a moderate J, moderate play it by ear, or extreme play it by ear? Tell them what you think. Okay, I'm just curious, just for grins, I'd like to see, you have to choose one, so you're not smack dab in the middle, so you gotta tilt, you know, one way or the other. How many of you tilt more towards the J side? You tend to be more of a J. Okay, how many are more on the P side? Yeah, like 50-50, that's kind of how the world is, so get used to it. We all have to deal with it. How many of you are married to someone who's the opposite of you? Yeah, oh wow. God has a great sense of humor, doesn't he? That's so great. Okay, so know that this is somewhat uncomfortable, maybe even more uncomfortable for you than others if you're a J. All right, second big idea is make time for solitude. When you're going through change, particularly in that neutral zone place, when you're trying to hear from God, you've got to make room for him to talk to you. And so it's an era of life where I invite you, even if you're not a solitude kind of person, to say, I want to create some space. I don't know what spiritual practices serve you best. For some, this is true of me, I love to take a walk, especially in nature, by myself, and give God some room in case he wants to impress anything on me. Some of you are journalers. You might want to write some things down, to sit there with a cup of coffee in your journal and start to just write and get it out. But make sure that you give God some room during this time. And even this week, if you find yourself in transition, I know there's lots of activities here and there's way too much fun, many, many options. But carve out a little time. And if you're married with kids here, give each other a little break if you can. Or if you're a single parent, get one of those babysitter people. What a great idea that was, you know. But figure it out so that you can have a little space to hear from God. It would be so very, very important. Also, I want to give you, this isn't in your notes, but an exercise that has been very helpful for me in the last few years. It originates back with St. Ignatius. You may be familiar with it. It's called Consolation and Desolation. Many people do this at the end of the day. Consolation means you sit down at the end of a day, for example, and you think, what were the moments today where I felt most connected to God or most connected to other people, where I sensed his presence in me, where I really was with a moment? What were those day moments today? And then what desolation is the opposite. When today was I easily irritated? When did I fly off the handle? When did I get impatient? Or when did I have improper thoughts? When did I feel bored? When did I feel distance from God? And you kind of look at your day that way. But there's another way to use consolation and desolation. It has to do when you're facing a decision. So, if you're in this neutral zone, at some point, eventually, some options might start to occur to you about what next might be, okay? And for some people, for financial reasons, they don't have much time to make that decision. I understand that. But when you're in this neutral zone, whether it's a professional decision or a moving decision or even a marriage decision, any of those things, you've got some options. So just to keep it simple, let's pretend you have two major options. You probably have more than that, but let's pretend you have two. So option A and option B. The consolation-desolation exercise when it comes to decision-making, I have found very helpful. First, let me say, there are some decisions we face in life where God makes it crystal clear what we're supposed to do. And some of you have had those. I've only had that a couple times. Starting at Willow and leaving Willow were two of those times where it would have been, I knew it would have been disobedient for me to not go the way God was leading. But I don't think all decisions are like that. And I think in the kingdom, we sometimes throw around the phrase, I was called, a little too loosely. Sometimes we are called. Sometimes we just made a choice. And I think there are a few decisions in life where God says, you know what, my primary agenda for you is what? Not a job. My primary agenda for you is to form myself in you. And I can do that in a lot of different places. So sometimes I don't think God has just one way, and if you miss it, you totally messed up. I don't think that's the case sometimes. I think if you make room for God's voice, if you're listening and you're not hearing one way to go, I think sometimes God is saying, you choose, my child. I can work with you in either of these places. I give you freedom to choose. Because I've always believed he's more than able to tell me if he wants to tell me, right? If I'm listening, he could tell me. And sometimes we don't know. So consolation, desolation exercise is maybe God is saying, you choose. So you look at option A and you look at option B. And the idea of this, and I learned this from Ruth Haley Barton, who's a wonderful teacher about spiritual transformation. She says, try on for a couple days, hypothetically, just hypothetically, choosing option A. Pretend that that's what you chose. And imagine, okay, I'm going to take this job, or I'm going to move my family here, or I'm going to marry this person, or whatever. And you try it on, and you test it in a sense, and see if it produces a sense of consolation. See if it's life-giving, if the whole idea of it is life-giving. Because I believe God wants to delight us. And you sit there and you imagine that future. And then she says, you switch. Okay, so you do that, walk around as if, for a couple days, I'm going to do option A. Now I'm going to switch. Walk around as if I'm going to do option B and test that and see if that produces a sense of consolation or desolation. Is this making any sense? Anyway, it's been very helpful for me, and it might be something you want to try if you find yourself facing that kind of decision. Okay, number three, come out of hiding. When you hear that restless voice, if that's what's going on, something internal, and some of you did this with me yesterday, and I felt very honored that you came, and some of you said, I think I might be facing a change. Come out of hiding when you feel ready, but come out of hiding to tell either a close friend or a spouse. You may not want to tell your boss just yet because you might not be ready to leave just yet. But come out of hiding with someone and be honest that you're feeling something you're trying to discern. You're not quite sure what it is. When I was about a year out from leaving Willow, I had annually led a big event called the Arts Conference. And it was for people who were in the worship and arts kind of ministry. And that last year, I think it was the last one, I invited different speakers to come. And I had invited Ephraim Smith. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he came to be one of the main speakers. And so, like everyone else, I'm learning from him. He's a very powerful teacher. And he told a story. And I'm going to get this facts wrong, so when you leave, if you're a fact person, don't go Google this, because I'm probably going to get the details wrong. But let's just pretend with some numbers. If there's a cheetah, okay, the animal cheetah, right? There is a certain distance that cheetah can jump from the ground. And let's pretend it's 5 feet. Okay, I don't know what it is. Let's pretend it's 5 feet. But when they are in zoos, okay, they will often have a 3-foot wall where the cheetahs are. So people think, why would you do that? If they're able to jump 5 feet, why would you do that? And the answer is, a cheetah will never jump if they can't see where they're going to land. That's how they're hardwired. They're just never going to jump if they can't see where they're going to land. And his point was, many of us are not willing to jump into the unknown, into the land between in particular, if we don't know what's next. We don't know what's next, and so we won't go. So I'm sitting there listening to this. I had already heard this little restless voice and had hardly told anybody. I'm like, ooh, interesting. So I'm driving home, and I get a text from one of my good friends, and he says, maybe Willow Creek is your 3-foot wall. That's all he said. And I thought, yeah, I'm scared. I'm scared to jump because I don't know what's next, but maybe God is prompting me to do it anyway. And for some of you, that may be the case. But you need to come out of hiding and let someone walk with you in this, maybe even a counselor, if that would be helpful to you. Number four, take care of yourself in little ways. When you're in a season, particularly of waiting, a land between, you can't spend every waking minute trying to figure it out. You'll just exhaust yourself, and no one else is going to want to talk to you either. After a while, they're like, oh, just shut up and make a choice, you know? So you eventually have to let it go and do some things different from that, like go get a massage or take a long run or whatever helps you. Maybe something physical would be good. I have found that God whispers to me often when I'm actually relaxed, when I'm not trying so hard, when I'm not sitting, you know, prayerfully waiting, but I'm just doing life. And then certain impressions start to come towards you. So take care of yourself in little ways. And do not miss the lessons. That would be the saddest thing, to go through all this and miss the lessons he wants to teach you. We have to be curious. Adopt a posture of curiosity. I wonder what God's trying to teach me. I wonder what could be learned in this land between. Jeff Mannion writes, dramatic growth requires pain. Remember this when you find yourself in a maddening detour. Remember that God is at work in all things, that he desires to shape and transform you. Resist the temptation, and this is what we all want to do, to zone out, numb out, or check out. We're like, I hate this. I just want to escape. God intends to grow something beautiful and deep and lasting, but we must cooperate with God for the season of hardship to work its intended transformation. Don't let your detour go wasted. If you don't hear anything else today, hear that. Don't let your detour go wasted. You are in training, and God is up to something good. My younger daughter, Johanna, is in a tricky year of transition because it's that first year out of college. And for some people like her, it's unsettling. You know, until you're done with college, life is pretty much, you go with the plan, right? And you have a set schedule and you know what you're supposed to be and where you're supposed to be. And then you graduate, and particularly if you major in theater, you don't know what's next. Yes, and so, you know, she's in this interesting phase, and she moved back to Chicago, but all her closest friends live somewhere else. So from a standpoint of community, a standpoint of her professional life, all of that, it's feeling very unsettling. And recently we had brunch with her. My other daughter was not available, and so the three of us went to brunch, and it was such a good conversation because you could just see that she's trying to find her footing. She's trying to trust God. She's asking, what am I supposed to learn, you know, in this new season, and what is God saying? If you're in a season of fall, I urge you to make the bold choice to trust God, to trust him, to know that his heart is for you no matter what. Jesus told us, don't let your hearts be troubled. He said, in this life you will have trouble, but then he also said, do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God and also in him. And if you're feeling anxiety in that land between because you're not where you were and you're not yet where you're going, you're in that scary place between trapezes, know that you are in fertile ground for growth, absolutely fertile ground. All of us are going to find ourselves in this season. Maybe you've listened to this today and you're like, you know, I have kind of heard that little restless voice and I haven't been paying attention. Maybe you're a J and you're like, I don't want to hear that restless voice. I really don't want to hear it. But the Heavenly Father is up to good. He really is up to good in all of our lives. That's what I've learned. And he will make something beautiful out of it if you trust him. I asked David if he could close our time this morning with a hymn that was written by someone when the winds of change were definitely blowing. Season of winter as well. It is well with my soul, which is a treasured hymn for many of us.